My next guest, or should I say guests, are on the line. Let me just reverse a little bit. Generally, we speak to Dan Brotman, our travel correspondent, at least once a week about some weird and wonderful country that he's traveled to and visited. And as I said, never one to miss an opportunity. Dan told me shortly before going on air this afternoon that he has an arrangement tonight, a speaking engagement in Toronto with a gentleman called Ilan Grappel. And what is in common, what both gents have in common, is they've both been arrested by Middle Eastern governments, Dan by the Lebanese and Ilan by the Egyptians. I don't think too many people can say that they have spoken to two such people on the phone before. Gents, great to have you with us on Chai FM. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having us, Simon.
Is Ilan there too? I'm just, you're there. Great, Ilan. We'll get you in just a moment. Dan, I want you to set the scene. In your travels around the world, you've been to Egypt. Give us a sense of visiting Egypt, the Jewish community. Just lay the groundwork for Ilan, who will then tell us his story.
Sure. So actually, I have an article coming out in the South African Jewish Report next week about Egypt and about some of my Jewish travels to Egypt. You know, what a lot of people don't know is that Egypt had quite a large Jewish community up until, I would say up until 1956. So in 1948, when the State of Israel was founded, Egypt had 80,000 Jews. Wow. And Egypt was a very cosmopolitan place. There were not only Jews in Egypt, there were Armenians, Greeks. It was very, very cosmopolitan. The Jews who lived in Egypt were predominantly French-speaking. And not only that, they were very diverse. There were Ashkenazi Jews who were born and raised in Egypt and considered themselves to be Egyptian. And basically, in 1956... most of the Jews in Egypt were stripped of their citizenship, stripped of their property, and there was a mass exodus. There was further a mass exodus in 1967. What many people don't know, and this is what I'm going to be, what the article discusses, mm-hmm. is that quite a number of Egyptian Jews went to Southern Africa. So when you talk to people in South Africa and you say we have Sephardi Jews, everyone always thinks, oh, descendants of people from Rhodes.
Rhode Island, exactly.
But they don't, they don't realize that we have a sizable Egyptian community in Southern Ireland, in both Zimbabwe and South Africa. So in my article, I interview both the descendants of Ashkenazi and Sephardi Jews from Egypt, from Southern Africa, why their families left Egypt, a bit about the history of the community, why it dwindled, and today there are only three Jews remaining in Egypt. So a community that was 80,000, there are only three now. That's even smaller than Syria. There are three elderly women left, and the youngest is in her 70s. So that is to say that within my lifetime, your lifetime, the community will probably be extinct.
Dan, go back to being a tourist, a Jewish tourist and an Israeli, actually, in Egypt. How did you feel?
So, in terms of Jewish sites in Egypt, the Egyptian government actually has gone to great lengths to restore some of the very historic synagogues. While I was there, I wasn't able to enter the synagogue they were restoring in Cairo. However, I was in Alexandria, and we drove past this huge, huge synagogue, and I really wanted to see it. Mm-hmm. And long story short, I was able to get inside. It's not open to the public. And I met the caretaker of the synagogue, whose name is Mohammed. He's an Egyptian Muslim. And the only language we had in common was modern Hebrew.
Goodness gracious.
He taught himself Hebrew. He taught himself Hebrew. He has never been to Israel, but he speaks fluent Hebrew. That's how we communicated. He's an elderly man. He told me, you know, he grew up in Alexandria. He remembers when the entire neighborhood was Jewish, when the synagogue was completely full. And now he's the caretaker of the synagogue that no longer has Jews praying in it. It was restored by the government. It's in excellent, excellent condition, Italian marble. It even has the names of the community members who had reserved seats in the synagogue. So I was photographing the chairs and the synagogue for descendants of Alexandria Jews. And what's amazing is next to the synagogue, there's a huge government school, just a regular Egyptian government school, but they kept the Hebrew letters on the school that says Jewish school.
Goodness.
So if you look carefully, there are signs of a very, very vibrant Jewish community that no longer exists. And this elderly man is responsible for ensuring that these sites are still preserved.
Before I talk to Ilan, just tell me about the event this evening. What is it, and what will you be speaking about, both of you?
So we're speaking at, for anyone who knows Toronto, we're speaking at the Prosserman Jewish Community Center, which is the largest JCC in Toronto. And we're speaking about what it was like for us 14 years apart, being arrested in the Arab world, accused of being spies for Israel. Our stories are very different. I've been on your show before and spoken about my story. Ilan can tell you a bit about his. Despite the fact that we were arrested in different countries, we were held for different amounts of time, there are still many commonalities that we experienced in terms of the psychological and human story behind losing all of your freedom and being held by people who don't really, you know, held by countries that don't have a justice system that is up to the standards that we expect in the West.
Ilan, Dan created the most wonderful segue for me to talk to you about your experiences in Egypt. We're all ears. Talk to us.
Sure. So in short, I guess now it's about 14 years ago. I was a law student and in the United States. And I had a background in the Arabic language. I've been to Egypt as well, as first to Sinai. That's a more common destination for Israelis. I went there after, before the army and then after. And then also I ventured a little bit farther into the mainland of Egypt, which is Cairo. I was attracted by, it's the hub of Arabic culture, and I already had a pretty strong Arabic background from the IDF. So I wanted to actually put that into practice, and I had the opportunity. This is also, I guess now in 2008 or nine. And when I was there, I was able to discover that there were so many misconceptions about Israel, about Jewish people. And since I was able to speak in Arabic, a lot of people were eager to learn more and also dispel their own misconceptions. So I found it was an exciting time. And Dan spoke about all the synagogues, and not only there are synagogues, there's also actually an Israeli academic center in Cairo. So there was always this hope that the relations between the two countries would improve, at least at the grassroots level, which never really did. But to my specific story, in 2011, I was a law student in the United States. I was in my second year. It was my second summer, and then I had an opportunity to work at an NGO there that was providing legal services to asylum seekers in Cairo. Since I had an Arabic background and a legal background, they thought it would be, or my university thought it would be a good opportunity for me, and that I was a good fit despite my background. They thought if I was going within an organized manner with the NGO, working in coordination with you, that would be a good opportunity. In the end, it was in the wake of the Arab Spring. So as a result, the streets were very, there was a lot of action in the streets. Mm-hmm. There were demonstrations and the like, and eventually the authorities who were following me and probably following they would follow any Israeli who would be in the country, thought I was too suspicious for their liking and decided to make an arrest. They arrested me. And they took me in for interrogations. And once that happened, it became headline news really around the world. And then even if they had their regrets, it was very difficult for them to issue or to admit that they made a mistake. Mm-hmm. So they had to really go in the other direction, which was that they captured the biggest spy since their previous Israeli spy, what they call, which was a Druze Israeli who was caught about 15 years earlier, Azam Azam. So they thought that they caught the next big Israeli spy, and they were looking to attribute to me all of the unrest in their streets, the demonstrations, the arson attacks, the attacks against the military. So those were the accusations which were lobbied at me, and I realized that with those accusations and within the headlines, it would be difficult for me to get out. Which affected it was difficult for me to get out. It took 4.5 months for the countries to find a resolution.
What happens when that does happen? You're an Israeli in a, there's peace, but it's a pretty cold peace. What resources do you have to rely on to get out of a situation like that?
Well, at first, the first day the United States came, the United States Embassy sent a representative or one of their two of their diplomats, and I thought within 24 hours, given that I was working, given that I was sent by my university, an American university, and the United States government was supporting me, and then and the NGO and the United Nations was working with me, I thought all that together would be my best chance of getting out shortly, and when they came and left within a few hours, I realized that. This would be a more difficult ordeal. So they were the ones the day after. The Israeli embassy sent a couple of representatives to see what my status was, and then they left as well. And then those are my resources. But it was difficult because I was really deprived of information, which was one of the biggest ordeals. I was deprived of information, and you're pretty much left. And that might be one of the common threads that you're left with then. That you're left to imagine what the worst could be, especially since I was in solitary confinement for most of the time. So I really had to rely on the bits of information that I got during my meetings with the embassy, which was only every couple of weeks or so.
How were you treated during that time of arrest?
I mean, it depends on the stay and the period over the 4.5 months. In general, solitary confinement is really a form of mental torture, and which a lot of or which prisoners around the world have suffered to various extents. And that was my main worry over the time that really they don't have to even touch me. They could just say, "All right, we'll come back in a month, and you'll be deprived of any human contact." And that in itself would be a very difficult ordeal. And that was part of their threats that they were making, but. At the time, nobody really knew what was going to happen. So the authorities were a bit worried. The Egyptian authorities were worried about how the United States would respond. So there was a lot of guessing work by both sides about what each side was going to do. So the solitary confinement was mainly the harshest treatment that I received over the time.
Were you treated worse or better because you were an Israeli American? And I'm just thinking in my
No.
mind's eye, you know, I've seen those pictures of defendants in Egyptian trials where they're literally behind bars in cages. I mean, this is not a legal system that you really want to be on the wrong side of.
Right, so I didn't get that far. We knew that. I think that comes when you're actually indicted. So the governments were trying very hard for me not to be indicted because they knew once it reached that level, then there was probably no going back. So they were hoping to find a diplomatic solution. And I knew that they had 6 months, the Egyptians had 6 months to decide whether or not they were going to indict based on their statute. So that was always a worry from me, from the American government, from the Israeli government about whether or not I would be indicted. And they would take me occasionally to courthouses for standard proceedings to extend my detainment. And I was never sure if this is going to be an indictment or if this is going to be an extension. Thankfully, it was always an extension until the end. But that was my main worry that I would get to the point where I'm actually behind bars in a courtroom. It would be a media spectacle, and we knew that we didn't want it to get that far. The goal was for the story to fall out of the media headlines. And then they would be able, then it would be easier for the
Interesting.
governments to find a resolution.
So, how did it play itself out?
After 4.5 months, actually about this time, what day is today? In Rosh Hashanah of that year, I remember my parents were allowed to visit at the prosecutor's office, which I felt was a good sign. And then I thought maybe I'd be going home with them, but like maybe or maybe I'd be going home with them. It didn't happen. There was talk that I'd be going home on Yom Kippur. It didn't happen, but the conditions started to improve. They started to give me the more newspaper. Like they started to give me more reading material, which was the most critical resource that I really needed to maintain myself during solitary confinement. So they started giving me the Egyptian papers every day, which was enough for me to. I mean, I'm a slow Arabic reader, so I was able to really read through it in depth for every day, and I was able to get a better picture of what was going on in the world. And there was a little bit the conditions. Were improving a bit, like the guards were able to talk to me a little bit more than they were in the past. And then about a month after Rosh Hashanah in October, at the end of October, in a month from now, in October, I think it was October 20th or somewhere around that time, the officers take me from my room, and I thought I was going to a standard prosecutorial interrogation of some kind.
Sure.
But instead they really kept me on where I was being held, which I assume was a military base. And they took me to a different building within the space, and then they put kind of pushed me into a corporate boardroom, which was a very different situation that I've been in. And they left me alone. The guards left me, and then all of a sudden I enter this boardroom, and there's two guys sitting on a couch, and then all of a sudden I hear Hebrew, like Manishma Ilan, like Israeli Hebrew.
Oh,
And then I like what? And I was like in shock. And then they introduced themselves. One was Yisrael Chasson. He's like, I'm from the Knesset. Another one was Yitzhak Malcho, which was Prime Minister Netanyahu's personal attorney. I said, we want to speak with you. We want to see how you're doing. Let you know what the status of your case is. Let you know that we've been working on your case for this whole time, even though you haven't seen us. We were behind the scenes. We've been really working hard, and we think that we're able to find a resolution. And then, so we talked for about an hour. There's a few pictures taken, so I thought that was a good sign. But then after the next days after that, I stopped getting the newspapers again, which I thought was a bad sign, because whenever they stopped giving me newspapers, it was because I was in the newspaper. So I was a bit worried that something would happen, that there's some sort of conflict with Israel, which happened in August, which probably extended my time. So I was worried that something would happen, that something happened to my detriment. But about a week after that, the guards called me down. They asked me what I want for my last meal. I said, "Oh, last meal before what?" And then they're bringing me a pizza to like to have some celebratory meal with me. And then they take me to the van, which they use to transport me. And then there was a bit of role reversal, because I always used to be blindfolded, and now they put on ski masks. They said, "No, you don't need a blindfold anymore." And then for the first time, I was traveling in the streets of Cairo or wherever, and I was able to actually see my travel, my route. And then eventually we get to a grassy field, a grassy knoll, and then they say, "This is where you part ways." They opened up the van doors, and they kind of pushed me out, and then they took off. They're still in ski masks, so I thought it was a surreal situation. And then there was a private plane there, a small little plane. From the plane, the two Israelis come down, like Israel, Yitzhak Malcho and Yisrael Chasson. They came down, and they said, "Oh, we told you we'd be back." And they gave me Yediot Achronot, the newspaper. And then, like on the newspaper, I saw the headline that Hatzachan Choser, the paratroopers, returning. I was in paratroopers. And I see, and I was on the cover of the paper, so I was able to learn what was happening based on the headline of that day from
Tell me about
And then,
tell me. Sorry, I'm just cognizant of time.
Yeah,
tell me
sure.
about the prisoner swap. What kind of guys were swapped for you?
Yeah, so then I learned. That's when I first learned about it, and I was worried because I knew the week before Gilad Shalit was released, and I knew it was politically controversial. So I asked, "So Chazlon, what you're releasing guys for me?" I was. I'm, he's like, so he said, "Don't take any offense, but we had no intention of releasing anybody that we actually thought was that we actually wanted." So, in the end, they released. It was about 25. It was 25 Bedouins from the Sinai Desert who were mostly convicted on drug-related charges. Many of them have already. They said many of them have already completed their sentences. They were just lost in the
Yeah,
bureaucracy.
because I've noticed
They're on the way out
that
anyway.
it's kind of clear that a guy like Gilad Shalit is being blamed for things that he had no part of. He wasn't involved in decisions, and the blame seems to be leveled at him, and it doesn't seem fair at all. You were released.
Doesn't seem fair. I mean, I don't know if you want to go in that direction, but I would just say that I just one comment on that. One is that that's definitely not fair, and the assumption that one guy from that deal, without naming names, that one guy from that deal was the reason, and that without that one guy, that they never could
Wouldn't
have
have
that they
happened.
wouldn't have the
Very
deal.
interesting. Very
I think
interesting.
it's also not necessarily a true statement. Like, there's 1,000 guys who were released, but the guys that does have tens of thousands of they're fighting tens of thousands of terrorists right now, or they've been fighting. Netanyahu has made that point many times, that comparison to the United States and Mosul, Israel is facing tens of thousands of terrorists in Gaza. So I'm not sure if it's specifically the ones that were released in the Gilad Shalit deal that were the ones responsible. I just will say that it's just to finish off on that point. I mean, that I do what the precedent is bad, because it gives the motivation to try. So that's definitely
Difficult
a problem.
situation,
The one to the one to the cost, the price, the one to 1,000 deal. However, the actual people that were released, I'm not sure if that was the thing that was a turning point that gave them the power to do what they did, as opposed to the other tens of thousands of people that they have capable of fighting. So.
Ilan, great talking to you. Final question to you, Dan. How do you account for the fact that there's such a warm peace between Israel, say, and the United Arab Emirates, and such a cold peace between Israel and Egypt?
Wow. I mean, I'm not a political scientist, but what I can tell you, just as a traveler, you really feel the difference. Even though Israel has full relations between both countries, you really feel the difference. So, for example, when I was recently in Abu Dhabi in April, Jews can wear kippot in the street. Israelis speak Hebrew in the street. Anyone who shouts "Free Palestine" gets immediately deported. There's really zero tolerance. And it's, again, I mean, you and I have spoken about countries where it's safe to be Jewish. The UAE, I believe, is an incredibly safe place to be Jewish today. Egypt, on the other hand, even full diplomatic relations with Israel, you know, Mein Kampf is sold in the street. Oh, and wow. I remember for me, that was very, very shocking. I think part of it is what the governments, respective governments, tolerate in terms of anti-Israel, anti-Semitic sentiment. And there's zero tolerance in the UAE, and they tolerate it more in Egypt. Again, as a Jewish person, I wasn't wearing a kippah. I felt fine in Egypt. Again, I think that for people who are thinking of traveling to the Arab world, I would definitely, as a soft landing, start with the UAE. It's incredibly, incredibly safe with kosher restaurants. But Egypt still has Jewish history that is worth seeing. And there's nothing like seeing the pyramids. You have to see the pyramids once in your life.
Dan, we're going to leave it there. Dan, Ilan, good luck for your jaunt this evening. Dan, we'll chat to you again next week.